I am reminded of the Episcopalian Bishop of Texas who went to the Lambeth Conference. That's sort of a 10-year gathering of all the bishops from around the world. And when he was introduced at the formal gathering, the butler called out the Lord Bishop of Texas, to which he called out in a loud louder voice, "Back home, I'm called George." And I actually met the Bishop of Texas, and it was confirmed to me that he actually said that at the Lambeth Conference. But it drew my attention to just how friendly the Texan situation is, and how much I've looked forward, in fact, to coming and meeting the students, and certainly delivering this lecture on the cult of Christian leadership, the Trojan horse in the midst of the church. A trendy new movement infiltrated the vast first century Roman Empire. It spread more rapidly than early Christianity. While not a religious phenomenon, its proponents were to achieve a cult-like status amongst their compatriots. The academy would now need this movement in order to attract students. Fathers would have to have it for their sons. Cities would require it of their politicians, and citizens would hanker to hear its megastar proponents in the theatre. Everybody wanted it, and so, like today, everybody needed it. It was a first century must. The result of this movement was that it transformed irrevocably the academy and the law courts, civil administration, and the culture for at least the next three centuries in the empire. And the success of its proponents was measured by a flock of besotted students of academics, clamoring clients who all wanted this attorney, ardent political followers who went in the procession, and adoring crowds at cultural events. It resulted in a major influx of funds guaranteed for the personal coffers of its promoters. There was, in fact, gold in them their hills. And this is a story not only of how the Latin West was won by it, but also the Greek East as well. Now, this Drumright lecture is being given on the 25th year of the death of one of your distinguished alumnus, who also lectured in this university. And I trust he would approve of my exploring this topic, because it relates to the interaction of early ancient Christianity with its vibrant first century world. You may not know, but in his postdoctoral period of research, he spent some formative time at the American School of Classical Studies in Athens. And that great institution has as one of its prestigious centre the city of Corinth. And it was there that this movement thrived in the first century. Given Professor Dumwright's United Airlines giveaway more than free Starbucks, and it's been bitterly cold in England, as we say, colder than a mother-in-law's kiss, and as a result, I'm sort of struggling a little bit. You'll have to excuse me. Anyway. But I believe he also would have given the thumbs up to an issue that seems to have undergone a virulent 21st century mutation, spreading to the podium and the pulpit. The rise of this movement occurred in the time of the Julio-Claudian era and coincided, in fact, with the beginning of Christianity. The virtuoso orators who were trained by it established what came to be called the Second Sophistic Movement. It created something of a cult of leadership and endorsed a concept of what I think is now a term being used in business manuals in the 21st century, a concept of followership, ghastly term. But given the importance of the verbal content of the gospel, those who delivered its message were automatically evaluated in the first century by sophisticated programmed audiences. And their evaluation of any speaker would be based on personal appearance, charisma, acquired communication skills with the capacity to engage, entertain, and play on the emotions of the audience using the most sophisticated rhetorical devices. And just as the citizens of the empire were deeply affected by it, the early Christian movement had to grapple with it, or like the rest of the culture, be gripped by it. How the first century Christians responded is the purpose of this lecture. And in conclusion, I want to ask one or two questions, or to throw one or two exocet missiles into the 21st century as to whether or not it's still alive and well in terms of the presentation of the Christian message. So I want to talk about the coming of the cult of leadership. And secondly, about the assimilation of the cult of leadership by the Corinthian church. And thirdly, the Apostle Paul's countering of this cult of Christian leadership. And any implications for the 21st century, of course, are entirely meant. First of all, the coming of this new cult of leadership. Until recently, ancient historians saw the second sophistic as an early second century AD phenomenon. And therefore, any attempts by New Testament scholars to argue that the elements of it could be traced back to the first century Christian communities would rightly have been judged as anachronistic. However, in the Roman East, early in the first century, we find evidence that enables us to parallel and profile its impact in a remarkable way. And I draw on my own work from two major cities, Alexandria, called the Second Athens of the Empire because its renowned academic resources and its intellectual tradition, and also Corinth, the most prestigious of all the Roman colonies in the Greek provinces. Our most important witness, in fact, is the intellectual Philo of Alexandria, who was a Jew, like Paul, a Hellenized Jew, who wrote in the 40s AD. He used this term and its cognates nearly 100 times, and he indeed is one of our most important witnesses of what it was like in the city of Alexandria. There are other important witnesses. A young man wrote home about the orators in the city. He had just managed to bash up his father's chariot, had gotten into trouble in the theatre. His slave had run away, and he'd run out of money. A good reason for any undergraduate student writing home to their parents. But he also is a very interesting perspective of a young student as to how he interacted, and we have Dio Chrysostom in his Alexandrian Oration who discusses this at some length. It's interesting that Philo of Alexandria describes the sophistic movement as one would use of a movement that was highly successful. He writes, a vast number of those who were called sophists, being admired in their respective cities, have attracted well nigh the whole world to look upon them with honour on account of their definitions and their excessive cleverness in rhetorical inventions and speech. He made reference to the sophist who is defined, and for our purposes, just a helpful shorthand definition, he was a virtuoso orator with a big public following. In other words, he was a specialist. He what we might call in Australia a sophisticated gas bag. And he managed to attract a large number of people who followed him. This is endorsed by people such as Jones, Barry Anderson, ancient historians. And Anderson further defines them as established public speakers who offered a predominantly rhetorical form of higher education, with distinct emphasis on its most ostentatious forms. They claimed that oratory was the mother of all other arts and sciences. So you can appreciate that young men were no longer sent off to be educated by the philosophers, but by the sophists or the orators. The philosophers had taught about lifestyle and cardinal civic virtues. But the sophists, it was about the rules of style, the importance of bodily presence, of how one looked, about gestures and voice management, and about rhetorical techniques that have been borrowed, indeed, right from the time of Philo Demas, from the actors on the stage. But these were seen as essential elements in the training of a young person for a number of professions. And if bodily presence was critical, then more than ever, young men pumped iron in a gymnasium that operated alongside of the academy. Now it was not about fitness, it was about image. Developing the body beautiful into a Greek godlike statue type, because that was the icon of the day. In much the same way as the Gucci, Calvin Klein, Da Vinci magnetic male look stares out at us from the advertising page telling us about aftershave lotions, and if you put on your face, you can somehow have that magnetic male look. It hasn't worked with me and good numbers of my friends. But you see, it was about the question of image. This is one of the critical things in the first century, about the question of how you looked. And not only was shape important for the virtuoso orators, if they were to appear like the Greek statues, confident and looking great, but also you must not be a hairy man. And so the removal of hair from the chest, arms and legs was done by means of pitch plasters that were poured over you and then yanked off to the accompanying cries of young men. But it was all worthwhile because it was part of the preparation to look godlike at the podium. And if you didn't have the physique, then of course you didn't seek the centre stage. How did you find a virtuoso orator? Well, they were in Philo and Paul's day taking the cities by storm. It had become the new funky thing. But like all of the Roman society's society, conventions very quickly established about how an orator would come to a city in order to tap the educational and other lucrative streams of city life. It was called an entry. The word eisodos is a technical term that was used. And what happened was the sophists would advertise a meeting with the elite in the city, at which they began seated in an encomium in which they praised the virtues of the city. And then they proceeded with skillful and conspicuous humility to present things about themselves in regard to their own CV. They talked about themselves in a very highly sophisticated way. Then the audience was given the opportunity to nominate a topic. And whatever topic they nominated on, the orator had to immediately, if he could, or within 24 hours, produce a great oration. He had to demonstrate his erudite knowledge by means of his superlative wisdom and oratory. If he passed the test, his career in the academy, the demos, in embassies to the governor and the emperor would be secured. And fathers would have to determine if this should be the virtuoso orator for their sons to learn the art of rhetoric that would open the doors to the academy, the courts, the city politics, and hang the expensive fees. It was worth it if you could get hold of someone who was a great virtuoso orator. And the orators enrolled students who were called by the Greek name mathetai, disciples, the same word used, of course, for the disciples of Christ. And the purpose was that you would talk like your teacher, you would dress like your teacher, you'd look like your teacher, and you'd walk behind him in procession in much the way that clients of patrons did. You were zealously loyal to him, and you were critical of all other academic orators. So strife and jealousy epitomized the relationship between the disciples of other teachers. The teachers were the leaders. The pupils literally and metaphorically were the followers. And there's two wonderful statues, in fact, busts in the museum in Athens of Herodotus Atticus, who was a very famous orator of the second century, around whom indeed the whole of the Lives of the Second Sophistic was written, and one of his and his student. And the student almost looks like Herodotus Atticus, because the aim was that you shouldn't look like a clown, but you should look like a clone of your teacher. And there you learnt the art of rhetoric. And from then on, every time you opened your mouth in public, you revealed whether your daddy's payment of enormous fees had been a good investment. and once you'd finished in the school, you began your career. But you had been influenced by this movement, and you had been changed by this educational metamorphosis, and you were never the same person again. You were very much aware of the importance of speech, the importance of the way in which you engaged the audiences to whom you spoke, whether it was in the academy, in the law courts, as a lawyer, wherever. I want to talk now about the assimilation of this cult of leadership by the church. If the second sophistic was alive and well, and in fact spreading like wildfire, do we have any evidence of how a movement depended on communicating its message primarily through the medium of proclamation, of announcement, dealt with this phenomenon? How do the Christians relate to this new movement? In one of the well-known centers of Corinth, the presence of this movement is well attested by Dio Chrysostom, Plutarch, Epictetus, Favorinus, and also Herodotus Atticus, who was the Athenian Corinthian wealthy benefactor, but the virtuoso orator par excellence. And it'll be suggested in this section that there's evidence of its impact in 1 and 2 Corinthians, and also maybe paralleled in 1 Thessalonians 2. Now, the reasons for suggesting that Paul's letters to the Corinthians reveal the impact of the sophistic movement on the nascent Christian community are as follows. Pardon me. Paul discusses his modus operandi with respect to evangelism, recounting that when he was sent to preach by Christ, he was not sent to preach by means of the wisdom of rhetoric, 1 Corinthians 1:17. He states that would have been a major distraction and would in effect have evacuated the cross of its saving significance. Had he presented the preaching of the cross in the rhetorical tradition, then people would have been focused on the messenger and not on the message and the powerful transformation it promised. People would have said, "What a great speaker." Paul wanted people to say, "What a great redeemer." So the medium through which people normally spoke in public context focused ultimately on the sophistication of the orator. But the Apostle Paul would not use the wisdom of rhetoric to present the Christian message because it would focus on him and not those to whom Christ had sent him, that is, the hearers. Paul also leaves a fascinating explanation of the approach he adopted when he came to Corinth on his entry. And as one reads it through, one gets clues that Paul is coming as the anti-orator to Corinth. "I myself," he said, "when I came to Corinth, I did not come using the superiority of rhetoric or wisdom, preaching the mystery of God." Paul himself is making it quite clear when he says, "when I came, I did not come." It seems to me that while he's not using exactly the technical phrase of a coming, he is giving an emphasis that there was a pre-planned strategy on his part as to how he would do things and also how he would not do things. On the topic of his presentation in Corinth, he said, "For I determined to know nothing in your midst, only Jesus Christ and him crucified." This clearly suggests to me that there was no nominated topic to be given by the audience on which Paul was to speak. The topic had been set, unlike the case of the orators. So Paul is moving in and didn't give the audience the opportunity to nominate a topic, as was often done when a speaker came to the first century world of Corinth. And in contrast to the robustness of orators with their bodily presence and their very confident bearing, Paul affirmed that "I myself was with you in your midst in weakness." The antonym to rhetoric in Greek is power. But Paul was there, he says, in weakness. And he presents himself as the powerless preacher by first century rhetorical standards. And I was also there in fear, he said, and much trembling. And this hardly is the expected confident bearing of the virtuoso orator of the day. We know that when a great orator, Polemo, walked on, he was so confident, he looked so godlike, he looked so wonderful, there was immediately a murmur of approval, we're told by philosophers, through the whole audience. But that was not the case with Paul. And Paul talks in 2 Corinthians 1 also about his method of presentation. He says that his rhetoric and his content were not in the persuasiveness of wisdom, but he said it was in a demonstration, not a demonstration borrowed from the lists of Aristotle's rhetoric to persuade the audience, but it was a demonstration of the spirit and of power. The orators were concerned about ethos, pathos, and proofs. Paul was not concerned about those things. Ethos, you had to act out, and it makes it sound so real in the way you spoke. In terms of pathos, you learn to play on people's feelings, to make them laugh, to make them cry, like some popular preachers do, and then to offer proofs. But Paul reveals a specific reason for adopting this approach, countercultural though it was, in the city that was proud of its oratory. It was in order that your faith, and the word pistis them in this in the context of rhetoric, of course, would mean proof, but it was that your order that your faith would not rest in the wisdom of men, in the preacher. Never, Paul says, but your faith and confidence rested in the power of God. They became Christians, not because of Paul, but they became Christians because this great message rang bells, and God confirmed it in the hearts of those who heard it. And therefore, Paul did not want the preacher to get in the way of the content of the message or the work of God. That would have been so easy had it been that Paul himself became a funky preacher in the first century and simply adopted these conventions, so he, as it were, landed smoothly and sounded good and looked like the Gucci guy in the way he approached things. So what is known about the entry of orators in the city? To my mind, it's very difficult to escape the conclusion that Paul, when he arrived in Corinth, did not take into account the fact that it was necessary for him to come counterculturally in terms of the presentation. Otherwise, the message would be moulded by the method. And Paul was very concerned that that should not happen. Furthermore, the activities of the orator's disciples were being replicated among the Christian disciples of the Messiah in Corinth. There was the giving of exclusive loyalty to one teacher over against another. Paul writes in 1:12, each of you is saying, I belong to Paul. I'm a Paul man. Another says, I belong to Apollos. I follow him. And the Apostle Paul is concerned that the Corinthian Christians are beginning to conceptualize the role of their teachers through the cultural grid of the secular teachers, and now beginning to give exclusive loyalty. Paul talks in 4:6 about how it is that some of the disciples of Paul are playing him off against Apollos, and the Apollos disciples are doing the same. We know that strife and jealousy were two characteristics of what happened between the disciples of the secular teachers. And behold, they're being replicated in the Christian community in Corinth. And that is why Paul said that their conduct is secular. For where there is strife and jealousy, he says, are you not being immature and operating in a secular way? For when you say that I belong to Paul, and others say I belong to Apollos, you're behaving like men, as the secular world does. Again, in a deliberate countercultural comment, Paul asserts in 1 Corinthians 3 that the church does not belong to the minister, but the minister belongs to the church. And there Paul is, as it were, turning on its head the concept of I belong to. No, these people have been given, the ministry's been given to the church. Now finally, in Paul's synopsis, he says that the Corinthian Christians are idolatrous in doing this. And he does this by asking two questions. Was Paul crucified on your behalf? Was Paul the crucified God? That would be an ass of an idea, in any way, the question of crucifixion. But the thought in the Christian community that their attachments to Paul was like an attachment that was idolatrous. It was hero worship and more than that. And he also, were you baptized in the name of Paul? I baptize you in the name of Paul, and you're now raised to walk in newness of life with Paul. No, Paul says. For him there was to be no cult of Christian leadership in this ecclesia, even though it flourished and was alive in the secular ecclesia of the body politic in the first century. And these two questions are preceded by another devastating one in relationship to Christ. It is blasphemous to think that you can divide up Christ and he is specially yours. He is the Messiah of all the church, and Paul in his opening thanksgiving makes it very clear of the centrality of Christ for each of the Christians. Now I find it hard to escape the conclusion that finger marks of the second sophistic are all over this opening part of the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, and indeed indelibly on the face of the Corinthian church. And that is probably less than half a decade since the founding of that church. 1 Corinthians shows that they have not come to grips with the cult of leadership, this new cult, but rather the cult had well and truly got the church in its grip. And people are now perceiving ministry through the cultural and secular grid of this cult, new cult of leadership. So little wonder it was first on Paul's agenda to address the many issues facing the Corinthian church. You and I would probably have gone perhaps for the moral problems, but Paul begins with this problem because it is a critical first stop in seeking to rectify much of the difficulties in the Corinthian church. So this Trojan horse had been admitted into the mindset of the Corinthian Christians, and it now coloured the lenses through which they saw all Christian instruction. And therefore it should come as no surprise that there should be interpersonal strife and jealousy and divisiveness in all the communal activities when the church gathered together. Now, in spite of what Paul was to write in 1 Corinthians, the newly ingrained movement's impact on the Corinthian community did not go away. In 2 Corinthians, one of the downers used by Paul's detractors was standard fare amongst those who were evaluating the suitability of people to speak. They said of the Apostle Paul, his bodily presence is weak. In other words, he looks like a weed. No chest implant. You can have them, I tell you. I saw it on a television program recently. I won't name the city, but it begins with D and it rhymes with palace. And you men can get chest implants, I promise you. No chest implant for Paul. No trainer could ever rectify the major reasons for not putting Paul on the stage of the church. And when he opened his mouth, it also says that he spoke like a wimp. His rhetoric is pathetic, low grade. And by first century sophisticated standards, it was a form of gutter Greek that Paul spoke. His letters may have been weighty and strong, but his bodily presence was unsuitable. If you really wanted to disqualify a person in the first century from speaking, this is how you did it. You simply said, just look at the guy. He could never make it. Let him write, that's okay. People did this in the field of law. If they didn't have the presence, then they went and became a nomikos, someone who wrote legal briefs. And so here is an incredible statement about the Apostle Paul. And here are Corinthian Christians who are also saying, assessing Paul now on the grounds of his unsuitability. So when someone says your bodily presence is weak and your speech is ineffectual, but the books you publish are quite good, it's almost like in the UK, in academic and so-called polite circles, when character assassinators say about a particular person who's awful, but he has a nice wife. In other words, he is a rotter, but his only redeeming feature is not himself, but the woman he married. Well, that was almost the equivalent, I think, of what was being said about the Apostle Paul. So here was a Trojan horse in the midst of the Corinthian church, threatening its well-being. How did it get there? It was not the Corinthian community was anti-Paul, as if he was the enemy, and they introduced this in order to spite him in a power struggle. They'd just written, as you remember, asking for Paul's apostolic rulings on a number of issues, and Paul commends them for following his traditions just as he delivered them to them. It was not that they deliberately sat down and schemed to effect an anti-Pauline coup. An enemy had joined their ranks under the cover of Corinthian culture, a culture of which all the inhabitants were extremely proud. Corinth, indeed, was a cultural clone of Rome as a Roman colony. It was a first century must-have, this oratory, and the academy and all the others had to have it. And why would the church want to look out of fashion? The church had to have it too. Who wants to look like a cultural weirdo in the conforming society of Rome and of Roman Corinth? Its members were proud, and they themselves followed the cultural norms, and no one wanted to be different. And we know how changes could be so quickly affected through icons and images. Had an enemy brought this into the church? No. The Christians had pushed the Trojan horse into the midst of the church. And they rejoiced that they were followers of individual teachers whom they cast in the role of leaders, although the only commitment they made when they became a Christian was that they would follow the leader, Jesus. That's amazing, isn't it? But the cultural programming was so strong that had such great appeal to them, that there wasn't a reflection on whether or not this is suitable, but simply they brought this aspect of culture, and it was through that that they actually reshaped the question of Christian ministry in the Christian congregation. My third point is countering the Corinthian cult of leadership. Deprogramming the effects of the Trojan horse's conquest on the mindset of the Corinthian Christians was no easy task. Having worked in Asia for 10 years and now working in the third world country called England, I find that cultural issues are indeed the most difficult to change. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians devotes more space to the impact of cultural issues than he does on moral issues. They can be dealt with fairly quickly. Culture is very difficult. And so in 1 and 2 Corinthians, we see a very difficult two-stage task being undertaken by the Apostle Paul. Paul lays out that they must perceive his and other apostolic ministry in 1 Corinthians 4:1 as servants of Christ. In terms of who owns them, they are his servants, and they are stewards. That is the task of ministry. Now, in a household, being a steward was a critical function, where the appointed person's task was to match the needs of the occupants with the household with the resources of the owner. He put together need and resources. And Paul speaks of his ministry. This is how you must think of us, that we are stewards of these mysteries. We are not inventors of them. We're stewards of the mysteries of God, and our task is to apply God's solution to the needs that are here. And what was required of the owner of a steward? That the person be found faithful, faithful to that task. Paul also indicated the conclusion of the 1 Corinthians that Apollos was not disposed to accept their invitation to return at this stage. He then commands in this context of how they are to think in relationship to this whole issue, this Trojan horse in the church. He said, you must be watchful. You must stand firm in the faith. You must be courageous. You must be strong. You must do everything in love. And you must be subject to the ministry of those who devote themselves to the service of the saints, of whom the household of Stephanus, of course, is named as one example. The idea that the heads of a household should take a servile position was something that would overthrow the whole of the Roman order, a society so structured. And to think that the question of ministry was one in which people were involved in the service of others. They were not there for me, but I am there for them. And Paul commends in 1 Corinthians 12 through to 16, the fact that it is the self-serving, it's not self-serving, but is being other people centered and serving that is the essence of Christian ministry. Now, one would have thought that would have ended the matter. But it's very surprising that as 2 Corinthians unfolds, that still there is this commitment to this cult of leadership within the Corinthian church. And so it is that in 2 Corinthians, Paul begins in a remarkable letter to attack this issue. The weapons they use are secular. They peddle the word of God for profit. There's money in them, their churches. While they may use from the secular manuals all these sophisticated approaches, and they could boast about their spiritual achievements, which Paul said were really not their own. At the same time, these detractors sought to denigrate Paul's ministry using the profile of the virtuoso orator, what is called rhetorical presence. Paul lacked it. As I mentioned before, his bodily presence was weak and his speech was ineffectual. They also engaged in what was called comparison, synchrisis, among themselves. And they measured themselves and their abilities against one another. Here were people who were meant to be ministering, but they were competing with each other. And Paul declares such activity as brainless, if you want a dynamic equivalent. They are without understanding as to the nature of ministry. And such was the power of secular programming in Corinth in the church. But they seem to have ignored Paul's commands and instructions and arguments in 1 Corinthians, and therefore they had only made the situation much worse. And so here is a remarkable letter. 2 Corinthians is unique. You will find no other letter in the ancient world that is so self-disclosing about personal vulnerability, something the Greeks and indeed the Romans would never do. Paul discloses, first of all, his vulnerability in a near-death experience. He then goes on to talk about the treasuries in earthen vessels, in cheap clay vessels, so the surpassing glory is seen to come from God and not from the Apostle Paul. Paul played the false teachers at their own game, in fact, in a remarkable section in 2 Corinthians of boasting. In first century parlance, he is playing the sophist over against the sophists. They catalogue all their achievements. And like other elitist leaders, these sometimes are found on inscriptions, official inscriptions, about how great I art, how great I art. But Paul catalogues all his achievements, but what are they? Problems, dangers, travel disasters. Never go on holiday with Paul. Travel disasters. And it culminates in a list in which he demonstrates how weak he is. So Paul is boasting, but he's boasting about all the things that have gone wrong. He is playing these people their own game. And you may not think it's very humiliating to be let down over a city wall in a basket, probably it's never happened to you yet, and to run away like a rat, as Paul did, to escape. But this is how Paul speaks about the entry of an orator in such excitement and joy and those things. But Paul himself is let down. And then Paul goes on to say, yes, things have happened to him. And he prays earnestly this one thing God would remove from his life. But God said, and it was always be true, that my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. And when I'm weak, Paul says, then I'm strong. So here is an amazing statement on the part of Paul. For them, it was all about strength. It was about power, rhetoric, all these things. But here is a God who plays to Paul's weaknesses to achieve his great purposes. And therefore, ministry looks so different from the funky first century leader that is being is in the minds and the ideals of the Corinthian church. Paul himself engages in a siege mentality example. He speaks about the weapons have divine power to pull down citadels. Every argument, every arrogant opinion that is defiantly erected against the knowledge of God. And his aim is to bring every thought captive in obedience to Christ. Paul is speaking about a battering ram here. In Roman warfare, you just kept hitting and hitting and hitting the wall. It was no quick task, but it was indeed a very effective task, because ultimately the citadel would collapse. People would have to acknowledge that what was their security is now no longer there. And Paul uses this as an example, that his aim in terms of writing to people with culturally, as it were, cemented views in their minds, that ultimately his task is to keep hitting at this wall until finally it collapses and people come in obedience to the feet of Christ. So cultural deprogramming indeed is a very complicated and sometimes a very onerous, but not a quick fix on one Sunday sermon Paul saw had to be done within the framework of the Corinthian church. And so it was that he has worked his way through in 2 Corinthians and reminded them that Christ was crucified in weakness, but he was raised in the power of God. And the preacher is weak in Christ. He's weak in him, but he shall live in an effective way in the ministry that he conducts to others. So for Paul, there's no place for the jock preacher. Now, we know the Corinthian church was spiritually stupid. We all know that because we as Christians are much wiser in the 21st generation than they were. And we would never dream of pushing into the fellowship of the church a Trojan horse such as a secular leadership model. We would never boast about our successes. Paul planted, Apollos watered, but only God makes the whole thing grow. So then, what is Paul? What is Apollos? Simply servants through whom you believed. I think that even the Corinthians would have been surprised to discover that there were 21 irrefutable laws of leadership that could be brought into the church, but maybe not. But you see how vulnerable our 21st century Christian mindset is. How quickly we can be subliminally changed. The world of advertising specializes in actual subliminal transformation of our values. Is this not an age in which we live in which people are concerned about image? What they're looking for? In terms even of the past, he has looked like a Gucci man, 2.5 kids, lovely wife, big car, beautiful suit, all those sorts of things. These are the images. And where are they from? The scriptures? No. They are drawn in from the secular culture. And so it is we have to say to ourselves, we know that the Corinthian church was stupid in the way they did things, but are we any wiser? in our day and generation? And have we in many ways become culture Christians, been programmed by the spirit of the age, and now we are reprocessing all things? So we now have also a cult of Christian leadership. In conclusion, we all appreciate the significance of the great parable Jesus told on the downsizing of the church, the parable of the sower and the seed. Over a period of time, it would downsize. We are well aware of the 30, 60, 100 club that Jesus intended for those who had genuinely embraced the message. And we know that effectiveness and fruitfulness is not a matter of strategies and techniques, or do we? 2 Peter lays this out. The secret of spiritual success is no secret. To faith must be added virtue. To virtue, knowledge. To knowledge, self-control. To self-controlled, perseverance. To perseverance, godliness. To godliness, brotherly love. And to brotherly love must be added love. And it says, if these things are yours and abound, then you will be neither ineffective or unproductive as a Christian. And your final entry to the kingdom of God will not be a fearful, but a wonderful event. So when we begin to look at the scriptures, we see how it is that the formation of those whom God calls into ministry, indeed the formation of every Christian in order to be a member of the 30, 60, 100 club, is the quality of one's life. The first century was concerned with what was called prosopon, with persona, with the outward things. But Paul writes in 2 Corinthians that our concern is with the heart of who we really are within. And so what we have here, in many ways, is a conflict that is still in operation, that still tends to invade our thinking and our understanding. And we are more children of our age, sometimes in the church, than we realize. So we would not dream, I hope, of pushing the cult of funky leadership models widely endorsed in the world into the church. We're too smart for that. And we've all agreed just to follow him. And that would be a good starting point for us to redraw our perception of our discipleship, our perception of Christian ministry, and indeed, it would take the focus away from the man. So when we leave church on a Sunday, we would not be saying, what a great preacher. We'll be saying, as Paul wanted, what a great God. The cult of leadership can undo that. And so here rests our challenge today. The Corinthian church just wheeled the Trojan horse in. Let's not be stupid.